Chapter 4. Write the Way You Talk by Jamie Buckingham.
I think there has been a significant change in writing over the last 8 years that is due primarily to a shift from the written word to the viewed word. The advent of television has changed everything about communication. And that has finally moved over into the field where we function and operate. The new technical things that have happened, everything from videos to fiber optics, are having a powerful influence on the world in which we live. The advent of the computer into Western culture, now world culture, has had as significant an impact upon society as the advent of the printing press did. And I think most of us are not aware of that. In fact, I think it's probably having more of an impact on society than the advent of the printing press. Because with the computer, mindset has changed. That did not change as much with the printing press, because with the printing press it took several hundred years, because even with the printing press people didn't know how to read. The majority of the world was illiterate when the printing press came. And when Gutenberg printed his first Bible, only the priest still could read it. The only difference was that it was not handwritten. Now it was typeset, but still everybody in the church was illiterate, and so they had to depend upon the priest to read the Bible to them. Because and it took a long time for literacy to take over. But with the computer, everything has changed, because all it did was take where we were and enhance it by a million times into a whole different area. But along with that, something else has happened on a very subtle level that has changed the mindset of communication that you need to be aware of. And I hope you're aware of it both as a writer and as a communicator, as a preacher. Because if preachers are not aware of it, they're going to become like the dinosaurs of old. They will phase out if they don't understand what's happening in the minds of their listeners, of the receptors, whoever are out there. And so we're dealing with television, we're dealing with the computer, and we're dealing with the change in the printed word. Now, I think perhaps nothing typifies the change in the printed word as much as the new newspaper, which has swept the nation, USA Today. USA Today is essentially television on paper. It utilizes all of the techniques of television, but they just put it into print. So you'll not find anything of depth in USA Today. It doesn't even try to beat the New York Times. New York Times will go into depth, or the Washington Post will sometimes do a deep analytical position on something. USA Today is sound bites on paper, is essentially what it is. And so you will find that most of the stories in USA Today are one paragraph long, sometimes two paragraphs long. That there's more space with headlines than there is with the body of the story. There's a use of color, which was a new innovation for newspapers today. Heretofore, the only time color was used was with the comic page on Sunday. And now we have newspapers that are printed in full color all the way through. USA Today is a computerized newspaper, of course. It's handled by satellite. News comes into their headquarters office. It is shot up by satellite and comes down, and the newspaper is printed in sections all over the nation. It's not like the old Wall Street Journal used to be that you got through the mail that you'd get 3 days afterwards because it was always printed on Wall Street. That has changed also as well. But now you have a national newspaper that is a true national newspaper, so that the Florida section is printed in Fort Myers. It comes rolling off the presses there, or in Cocoa Beach, or in Reno, Nevada, or wherever, all handled by the way of satellite communication, and you've got instant news on print, just as you have with CNN that's there. And some now we have the possibility of a newspaper being almost as up-to-date as on-the-spot reporters, because of this instant thing that has taken place in communications. But you see, in order to do that, you can't go in depth. You can't, the newspaper writers cannot, they don't have time to stop and analyze. They do what the television commentators do. They just give you whatever's happening right now. And that's all you get. You don't get the reasons behind it. You don't get the philosophy behind it. The best they can do is to go out and interview a few people on the street, and you get a few comments, and that's about it. But you never really get foundational stuff. Now, whether we agree with Al Newhart or not, who is a kind of a heathen of the first rank, really, former publisher, now retired, whose book, which has done very well because he has promoted it, Confessions of an SOB, and is very accurate and on target. Whether you agree with Al Newhart or not and his concept of USA Today, or with CNN, or even more with CNN, with headline news, which is there, all you get really is the headlines. And I'm not here to run down or to play up what they're doing. That has changed the face of communications. Now, you need to be aware of that when you're writing, that the majority of the people are reading either the news magazines or they're reading the newspapers, and when they then pick up your sermonic book, they have a terrible time getting into it. They may want what you have, but they simply can't get into it because their minds have been changed. That there's a way to do this, to encompass what's happening in the world, and at the same time not to lose the depth that we want to go to at the same time on everything.
Jump off of this for a minute. I think this whole concept about people's attention spans and losing them is a very important point. You know, we grapple with this in our magazines, and we write our magazines for this, what we call the skip and jump reader, because we know, well, you know from your own reading habits, that you skip and jump through a magazine. Now, magazines are partly written for that, whereas a book, you write it, start on page one and go all the way through. But have you ever noticed in a magazine article a large quote out? We call them quote outs, different magazines, where something is large type. That's to get your attention. And the main thing we're trying to do with that is the person who starts in the back of the magazine reading Jamie Buckingham's column. A lot of people read the magazine backwards. And we want to rivet their attention with that quote out so that they'll go to the beginning of the article and read the whole article. And then we write a headline and a subheadline, and we have a large initial cap, all to get their attention into that article. And we're constantly trying to find new ways to help people to read easier and faster, because people don't read very well anymore. And one of the things that we're trying to do with at Creation House for our very first time is we're going to start putting quote outs in our books. We're going to do it in Jamie Buckingham's, in Larry Lee's book first. And we're also trying to work with the artists to do some things to make the type more readable. You know, somebody already suggested the large type and the leading, which is the amount of space between the type. You know, a lot of people have bad eyes, too. I mean, look how many people in this room wear glasses, and the rest of us wear contact lenses. And trying to figure out if a jagged right is more easily read, and these kinds of things. And even as you write your manuscript, if you think of these kinds of things, there are things that you can do to help the reader. For example, a really catchy chapter heading might get them to read the chapter, and you want something that's going to draw them in rather than something that's going to tell them they don't want to read the chapter. Or maybe putting some what we would call subheads in throughout the article, where you take a break and you put like a little headline. It breaks up the type, and also as a person skims, you know, a lot of us like to skim read books. I like to read 4 books a week. Even if I could skim read the books, I would. I don't maybe have, you know, 8 or 10 hours to sit down and read a book carefully, but if I could read it in 30 minutes or an hour, I would. But most books you cannot read through quickly.
Right.
Now, these are things that we're grappling with, and I tell you this partly because you can work with this, particularly if this sparks something in you where you'd maybe like to be a guinea pig. We might try some different kinds of things. You know, we're a little hesitant to, just mainly because people have been doing books the same way ever since Gutenberg, and it's awfully hard to change. But with the new technology now, it is so much simpler. Before, there were sort of technological reasons not to do it, but now we can really do anything we want with the advent of the computer.
When I was outlining the book that I'm in the process of writing now, in this summer miracle, my wife only had 2 requests of me. One is that the book is short, and one that the type is big. That's she's looking at it from an occasional reader who does not read very much. What I'm leading into with all of this is that you need to realize what's making it easier for people to read out there. USA Today has come up with an innovation that many magazines had just toyed around with, but they've made it a part of their thing. They call it the bullet. And so if you'll read their columns and read their articles, you will find that they're broken up with bullets. And bullets are nothing more than dots over here followed by incomplete sentences like this. And in the middle of an article, there will be 4 bullets that'll just sit there in the middle. You're not aware of it unless you stop and look at it. But the next time you pick up the newspaper, you'll see these things that are there. We use them in our magazine columns all along. I've insisted that our columnists for Ministries Today learn to use bullets. If you don't use bullets, at least use numbers. So you'll come along and say, there's 4 things I want you to know today. And suddenly, instead of giving 4 paragraphs, you just give these pieces of here, and then you trust the reader to try to put the rest of it together. In his own mind. So you save space as you're doing that, plus the fact you're hitting the reader where he is. Now, let me tell you the basic difference. Let me tell you what's happened in American communications today. I think it's 90-10. 75 years ago, 90% of the people in America were engaged in industrial or agricultural forms of careers, and 10% were engaged in communication forms of careers. Today, 90% of Americans are engaged in communication forms of careers, and 10% are engaged in agriculture and industrial forms of careers. 90% of our people are somehow engaged in communication forms. That's telephone, that's television, that's entertainment, that's computer usage. All of those things are communication forms. The printed word,
preaching,
yeah, all of that is all communication. We have become a nation of communicators. And as such, we are being inundated with the communicative word. It's coming at us from every side. There's more competition now for the word that you want to preach than there has ever been competition, because we are all involved in communication. Now, what's happened is that we have shifted from being an analog mentality to a digital mentality, because our technical world has gone from analog to digital. Our watches have gone from analog to digital. All the watches were like Betty's handbook here. They used to all be analog with sweet second hands like this. Now everything has gone digital, unless you've got a watch like mine, which is both analog and digital.
Even your bathroom scale.
Everything is digital. Your radio. It used to be the old long P, the LP records. Now we have gone to compact disc. Compact discs are all digital. If you looked at them under a magnifying glass, you would find that they are not circular. There are a series of little digits in there, which allows the searcher to go immediately to wherever it wants to go, wherever you command it to go, to pick those things up. All of our computers are digital. By digital, I mean they work in increments. Little bits of things that are jammed up against each other all the way through, rather than the large, sweeping secondhand. It would be very difficult for us to sell Moby Dick today. Moby Dick is analog. It's a huge, sweeping, panoramic story that starts here and goes on and on and on. But you can sell Robert Schuller, who writes in digits, or his writers write in digits. And when you're that wealthy, you can afford the best to ghost it for you and still get the credit for it. But he has learned to do those things in digital form. Now, there are certainly exceptions. How many of you ever picked up one of those big, thick novels? Yeah, Michener, for one. I have started four Michener novels and have not finished any of them, including The Source. I did get almost through to the end, but I just finally just caved in under this thing. I mean, I couldn't remember where it started was the problem, because he'd carried me for 4,000 years through this thing. Of course, that's classic Michener. But we're not going to reach that group of people, because that's not the group of people that's out there.
It's interesting, the Paredes books are so wordy. I mean, they just go on and on. The detail is...
Paredes books, if Paredes continues to write that way, his books will fall off and off and off until nobody's buying them. Those books had a strange kind of anointing on them, mysterious kind of anointing on them. It was the right time at the right place. God was saying something about spiritual warfare. He's kicking it off with a novel. And a whole lot of other things. Amy Grant was not the only one that endorsed her books. I went out and bought 400 of them and insisted that all of our church leaders and everybody else read the thing, because it was kicking off some things that we had been saying, but he just said it so much better than we had. But you can't continue on like that. The man you need to read anything you can find by Rudolf Flesch. Rudolf Flesch was an Austrian who died last year. English was his second language. He moved to America and became the world's expert. Books that he wrote, How to Be Brief, How to Make Sense, The Art of Readable Writing, which was his probably the best one he wrote, How to Write, Speak, and Think More Effectively, and probably half a dozen other books. But he was the one who came up with this concept of write the way you talk. He did a number of things for Reader's Digest in this, and I have simply taken some of the things that Rudolf Flesch used, and I have adapted them for what I want to give you now. But you can use this in magazine writing, you can use it in letter writing, you can use it in any kind of writing you do. You certainly use it in the writings of your books. And let me tell you what I'm talking about here. Start with outlining. Good communicators, whether speaking on their feet or whether they're writing, know where to start and where to stop. I have listened to you as you have made your comments here. All of you had a point that you wanted to make. You've made that and you have shut up, fortunately, or we never would be able to keep going here. And you knew that you had one point and you wanted to say it in a limited amount of time, and you have said that as you have made your lateral contributions here. A writer needs to know where he's going to start and where he's going to stop. He needs to work from some kind of an outline. Now, an outline has a beginning and an end. You don't necessarily need to outline the way you were taught in high school, with Roman numeral 1, Roman numeral 2, numeric 1, 1 in parentheses, little a in parentheses, capital A, all that kind of stuff. Some people write that way. The problem is when they write that way, usually it comes out looking that way at the same time. But you need to have a general idea in mind before you start as to where you're going and where you're going to end. When John and Elizabeth Sherrill wrote The Hiding Place for Corrie ten Boom, they knew where they were going to end that book before they ever started. Now, there was a lot of pressure on them, primarily by Corrie ten Boom, to carry the book on out farther. But they said, no, the story is over when you're released from prison. Because the story question, remember the story question, is what's going to happen to Corrie ten Boom? Well, what's happened to her was that she was released from prison. She served her time in a Nazi concentration camp for aiding and abetting Jews. And then by the grace of God, she was released, and all those wonderful things that happened to her made up The Hiding Place. And they cut it off right there. Now, they did her a great favor by doing that, because that allowed then for other authors, including myself, to pick it up and write additional books beyond that about what was happening to her then. But they knew where they were going to stop the book. You need to have that concept in mind when you start. If you're going to write a book on, Richard Foster wrote this magnificent book several years ago on the celebration of discipline. It has recently been re-released, and he had 12 classic disciplines that he wanted to deal with. So that's going to be a 12-chapter book, with an introduction and maybe with some kind of epilogue at the end. But those would be brief. But he knew that he had 12 chapters, and so he outlined that thing with these 12 chapters. It was a very easy outline to follow. You don't go 13, you don't go 14, you don't divide it one chapter into three parts. Now, he took one of those disciplines, if those of you who have followed Foster, who is a wonderful Quaker scholar, took one of those disciplines and turned that whole thing into a second book, a whole book on simplicity. And made another book out. He could have done it with each one of those, but in celebration of discipline, he just wanted to do it one chapter at a time. So you start with outline, because that's the way the mind works, and you want to write the way the mind works, write the way you talk. Number two, think small. Everything about writing should be small rather than large. The only thing about writing that's large is research. But you want to think small. You want to think short sentences. You want to think short words. You want to think short paragraphs. You want to think about how can I keep this book short without letting it get longer. Because there's a tendency on the writer's part to just let it go bigger and bigger and bigger. And a good editor will constantly cut and cut and cut. Until it fits. Now, editors may be trying to work it inside of a page minimum at the same time, because he knows if it goes into the next signature of pages, that your price is going to go up. And if the price goes up, that does not necessarily mean profit goes up. It may mean that buyers fall off when the price goes up. So he's trying to keep it at a proper profit margin and yet keep it short at the same time. You, as the writer, because of the very things that I've been talking about here, about this whole digital age in which we live, need to learn to write short sentences. 7-word sentences, 12 words maximum. I count the words in my sentences all the time. I count them. If I've got a 24-word sentence, I know that I'd need to cut it at least in two. And by that, I don't mean by doing it with a semicolon. I mean, I had to come back and cut the thing down. Now, there are exceptions. There's always exceptions. But you need to learn to think short when you do that. You need to learn to write in a straight line. Don't chase rabbits with your paragraphs. Just say it. Now, you can say it with a few good adjectives, and you can use figures of speech in that. Let me give you an example here. This is my April column for Charisma, in which I've built the whole column around a hunting trip that I went on back in December. The last morning of the hunt, the alarm went off at 4 a.m. I've dropped down into the middle of this, so I'm not going to give you that. I'm just giving you a couple of paragraphs. Rather than going out, I opted to stay in camp alone. I snuggled into my sleeping bag. I listened as the men dressed, checked their weapons, quietly made their way outside. I heard someone start the big swamp buggy. Each one of those sentences is about 7 words as I'm doing this. Minutes later, all men aboard, it rumbled out into the darkness. Its oversized airplane tires were squishing across the swamp, taking the men to their tree stands. Just before dawn, I got up, dressed, and walked outside. The brilliant stars provided light. I found a huge oak which formed a natural chapel. I sat on a low branch, my back against the rough bark of the trunk. I watched the sun as it resurrected the world. All of those are very, very, very short sentences. That's a style that I just had to work on and work on and work on. But I'd rather chop my sentences than have some editor chop them. And so I said, it's far better for me to do my rewriting than for somebody else to do it. But if I don't do it, they will. So remember what I put on the board yesterday. Good writing is rewriting. But at the same time, even with short sentences and short paragraphs, those are two paragraphs that I've given you there. With short sentences, I can still work in figures of speech. You watch the sun as it resurrects the world. That's personification. If we're working with four basic figures of speech, a simile, a metaphor, personification, and hyperbole, if you can remember your eighth grade English. We should use those as we go along. But you can use those in short sentences just at the same time. Few things on earth match the beauty of a Florida sunrise over the Everglades. Slowly the sky turned from blue velvet to a brilliant rose. I've put in just a couple of adjectives there. You don't need many adjectives. You're dealing with nouns and verbs. But you drop in enough adjectives just to give color to it. Slowly the sky turned from blue velvet to brilliant rose. The forest stretched, wakening its inhabitants. That's personification again. See, in personification, basically what you're doing is your inanimate object takes on human characteristics. And so I've allowed the forest to stretch. and wake up the inhabitants, which is just pure personification. It's my story, it's I.
So it's okay.
Don't write, by the way, for goodness sakes, don't use the royal we. There's no place for it. We don't do anything. Even when my wife and I do it, it's not we. It's Jackie does it and I do it. Now, we may walk together, but I can't write a book. My wife and I can't write a book together. She has to write the book or I have to write the book because of the point of view. Otherwise, the reader will not know who's talking. Now, full of stories. We had this wonderful situation several years ago with Graham and Trina Kerr. Some of you remember the Graham Kerr, who's the galloping gourmet. He was with YWAM. And Graham had this marvelous experience with the Lord and went crazy. And the Sherrills were going to write this book for Graham, and Graham decided that God had been speaking to him about his relationship with his wife, and he should not do anything without his wife, so the book was going to have to be a plural book rather than a singular book. Well, there's really no way to do that. They thought, well, maybe we can write it one chapter by Graham and another chapter by Trina. And that really was going to throw the reader off. Graham even suggested that what they should do is he write the first half of the book by Graham, and then the second half of the book would be upside down, where you would start at the other, you turn the book over and start and read back towards the middle the other way, and that would be by wife. And so he would be on one on the front, and she'd be on the back, but it'd be upside down, so you couldn't tell the front from the back either way. It was a mess. It was a mess. They finally just didn't write the book at all because they never could determine who the author was. You are the author of the book. Now, you can be writing about somebody else, back to viewpoint, or you can be writing about yourself. If you're writing about yourself, the use of I is fine. I got up in the morning. We didn't get up in the morning. I got up in the morning. And I trust that you'll never drop over into the third-person usage of yourself like Jerry Falwell when he speaks of himself in the third person. He calls himself, you know, he doesn't say, I did this. He says, Jerry Falwell did this.
Don't you think a lot of self-conscious people are really self-centered?
Oh, yes.
I'll not judge that one. I'll let you judge that. Use your figures of speech, but use them briefly. Go back and study. Find out what it... Here. Get hold of it. Strunk and White. The Elements of Style. It's the classic. There's never been anything written better than Strunk and White. In the Elements of Style. William Strunk, Jr. and E.B. White. Let me read you what William Strunk had to say. Vigorous writing is concise. A sentence should contain no unnecessary words, a paragraph no unnecessary sentences, for the same reason that a drawing should have no unnecessary lines and a machine no unnecessary parts. This requires not that the writer make all his sentences short or that he avoid all detail and treat his subject only in outline, but that every word tell. That's 63 words that was written 77 years ago that has never been improved on as far as writing style is concerned. Every word tell. And so you learn to chop. I learned early on in my writing to write to space. My first writing I ever really did of any kind of formal nature, other than writing letters to my fiance when I was off in college, and I wrote her every day because she wanted me to do that. And after a while you run out of stuff to write, so you start writing detail, which is really good. You know, you start talking about the trees and the grass and the size of your room and what your roommate did, and I'm indirectly indebted to my rather possessive and jealous fiance, whom I later married, who wanted me to write her every day because she forced me into sitting there in a little orange crate with a little portable Underwood manual typewriter and write these rather lengthy letters, which fortunately she later got rid of. But the first writing I did was radio scripts. I had a 4.5-minute daily radio program at noon, following the news. The news was from 11:55 to 12 o'clock, and then I came on right at 12 o'clock on a daily radio program in a little South Carolina town where I live, with a 4.5-minute perspective on the news. And I wrote out every script. I did not freelance any of that. And you learn in a hurry, don't you, Judson? You know exactly to the letter how much time you've got with that kind of thing. And so I knew exactly how much time I had. I had a 15-minute or a 20-second lead-in and a 10-second cutoff at the end, and then I had 4.5 minutes, and I knew exactly how much space that took on paper, double-spaced. It took one full page and 4 lines on the other side. And that was 4.5. And I learned to write to space, and I did that for years. Later, I wrote a newspaper column that was written to space. The columns I write now for a magazine, I write to space. I know exactly how many words it takes, how many characters it takes to fill that thing up and make it come out right. Book writers need to learn how to do that. You'll be a much better book writer when you learn how you say, okay, I'm only going to have a 3-page chapter. All of my chapters are going to be 3 pages long, or all of my chapters are going to be 5 pages long, or whatever. And then you force yourself into that discipline, because that's the way people think. How long should a book be?
150 pages.
Yeah. That's about it, because that's all you're going to be able to do and get it in at a decent price anymore. So it may be that the market is going to demand that you start disciplining yourself to make that work. It's just like the size of your girth. I mean, the fact that you're big does not necessarily mean that you're better. you need to learn to think small. Now, in doing that, you'll need to do your own editing, and we'll not have time if we had a workshop here. Let me show you something here. There's a sentence. The English language is about 1/2 redundant. Now let me show you what an editor will do with that. You can take half of it and cut it out, and it still says the same thing. Not only does it say the same thing, but it says it better. And all I've done is cut 4 words out of it, out of that 8-word sentence, until where we wind up with that. Now that's all editing is. It's just sizing. It's just cutting you down to where you should have been to start with. And if you'll learn to start writing that way, you won't have to go through all this other stuff that goes on, that takes so much time to get your book into print. Good writing is rewriting. Number 3, avoid shop talk. You understand what I mean by that? I'm talking about the language of Zion that only you and your fellow pastors understand. You ever gotten letters from Nigerian pastors? They're English speaking, you know, or Kenyan pastors, and they all sound like King James English. That's because the only thing they've had to read has been King James English. And they have picked that up, and their letters sound like epistles written from Rome. Back to the church in Jerusalem, you know. They're 2,000 years behind time. And I get these letters, and I try to cut on down, all the way down through. What is this fellow really trying to say to me? Well, what he's trying to say is, will you send me some books or send me some money? I know what he's saying. Okay. Avoid shop talk. And that's really difficult. But you need to understand that the majority of the people, the reason that the Living Bible has become so popular is it avoids shop talk. The NIV, to some degree, does that. It has dropped away from the old idioms of these and thous and other areas that we don't use anymore. The problem is that most preachers talk the language of Zion, and nobody understands that language anymore. I've always felt it was interesting how most prophecies come in King James English. So it's a matter of trying to, as you speak, if you were speaking to an unsaved person, you wouldn't speak that way. If you're out, when you're talking to the Rotary Club, you don't use the same kind of vocabulary that you do when you're talking to your church. You come at it from a different perspective. It's just a new challenge, that's all. And that's all I'm challenging with. I clipped here something out of a journal the other day that talked about the biota exhibited a 100% mortality response. And you know what that means? All the fish died. A shop talk. Okay, I use them. Use concrete words. English is a marvelous language in that we have a variety of words to describe the same action. And you're not stuck, especially with our verbs. We have the most colorful verbs of any language in the world. And God has gifted us with English is a very difficult language, I understand, for foreigners to learn because of this very thing. Because we have, well, not only that, but we have lots of words that that sound the same but mean different things. You shoo a fly away, but you also wear the thing. And so it's difficult for people to learn English oftentimes as a second language. But we have these marvelous verbs that we can use. So if you talk about walking across the room, you don't need to walk across the room. There's a score of ways to get across the room. You can stagger across the room. You can slither across the room. You can dance across the room. You can run across the room. You can crawl across the room. There's all these different ways, and the good writer is constantly looking. So what you're doing in your writing is you're always going back and saying, did I use that same word again? And so make use of your thesaurus or your dictionary of synonyms. A thesaurus is just an absolute tool. And I'm old-fashioned enough, and I still stick with Roget's. They now have a modern version of Roget's thesaurus that I use. But I'm constantly looking. I've already used that word. Now, there's some words you run into, like suddenly, that it's hard to find synonyms for. And so you have to hit it from a different position. You may have to even use phrases, but you don't want to constantly use these redundant words and phrases. But you do have all of these wonderful concrete words that you can use. And by concrete, I mean words that conjure up an image the moment you say them. Green shirt. Stagger. The moment I say that, everybody's got some kind of image of somebody who's staggering, and you specifically do that. You don't just talk about a man. You talk about a bald-headed man or a bushy-headed man or a you give some kind of descriptive adjectives as you go along, or sometimes they're descriptive nouns even with this. And so use your concrete words, but use them very sparingly. But make, we're back to what Strunk said, make every word count. I sometimes will use a fog index. This is a kind of an interesting thing to do. And I'll add up all the words in a typical passage, and then I will go back and I'll look at those words and say, how many of these words are three syllables or more? And if there's any words that are three syllables or more, I'll cut them out.
Or look at them seriously.
Yeah. If maybe that's the only, you know, if I have to use transubstantiation, there's probably no other word that I can use without getting into a whole paragraph. But basically, if I've got a three-syllable word, I'll look for a two-syllable word to try to say it better, especially if I've got a four-syllable word. I'll find something to cut back on that. I'll look at the length of my sentences, and I'll find if there's any way I can cut that sentence in two, I'm better off by doing it that way. To have a 7 or 12 word sentence rather than a 20 or 30 word sentence. I use semicolons very sparingly, because a semicolon, all it does is connect two thoughts in the same sentence. Usually where you use a semicolon, you're going to be better off using a second sentence rather than the use of the... semicolons are for poets. They're not for prose writers. Poetry doesn't sell, that's for sure. I oftentimes will have a reader in mind. Back to my early radio days. I remember going into the studio the first time I went on the air with my little program, and we had one of those big old mics that had all those perforations in it, all the little holes in it. Remember those old mics they used to have, and the great big stand-up table mics that you would have? And I was in there preaching into that microphone, and the announcer, who was a really wise guy, came in after I finished, and he said, "You're going to lose your audience the very first day. He said, you can't shout into that microphone." He says, you can't do that." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, people don't listen to radio in groups. They listen to radio individually." And he said, "You've only got one listener." Now, he said, "What I want you to do," he says, "you see that microphone sitting in front of you?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "I want you to picture there's a little man inside of that microphone. And he's got his ear up against one of those holes in that mic. And when you come back the second time, I want you to talk to that little man in there. And he says, if you'll talk to him, all of your listeners out there will be listening in." Mm-hmm. "Ah. Hi, come back in. Hi in there, how are you?" "Doing okay? A little cramped in there, isn't it?" "Well, I've got something that's really going to help you. Let me tell you what's been going on out here in this outside world." And suddenly I had the whole town listening to me in this little town of Greenwood, South Carolina. Because I wasn't, everybody else, every other preacher who came on the radio was preaching. And this guy that came on at 5 o'clock in the morning, "Hello, world!" You know, well, who's up at 5 o'clock in the morning? Is that the few chickens out there, you know? Well, I read, people listen to the radio in their car. Well, reading is the same way. You don't read in groups. You're a single reader, and the author needs to have, remember how Roosevelt, well, few of you remember Franklin Roosevelt, Murray Fisher, with his fireside chats, and here's the nation that's fallen, yeah, Garrison Keillor the same way, nation fallen to pieces, and the President of the United States comes on, and it's just you and him, and he says, "Pull up a chair here beside the fire. I got something I want to talk to you about." And suddenly you and the President were sitting there together on radio, and he won the hearts of America with his fireside chats. Simile. Comparison of two things which in their general nature are different from each other. Anytime you use a simile, you'll find the use of the term like or as. with it. He is like a strong tower. That's a simile. A metaphor is an implied comparison. Instead of making the comparison, as with the simile, the likeness is given in the form of a statement. So in simile, he is like a strong tower. In a metaphor, he is a strong tower. And be careful not to mix your metaphors. That's a common thing that writers do. Yeah, it's an implied comparison. But the likeness is in the form of a statement. So watch your use of metaphors. Here's a mixed metaphor. He is aflame with a thirst for God. Come on. Life is not all a rough sea. Sometimes the pathway is smooth. You've mixed your metaphors. The third figure of speech is personification. And in personification, you give a human characteristic to an inanimate object. The forest stretched. Remember the marvelous sentence out of Gone with the Wind, the opening sentence of the fifth chapter. Winter came early, and hunger rode the winds over the red clay hills of Georgia. Just beautiful personification with that. Hyperbole, Steve referred to that yesterday. Hyperbole is exaggeration for the sense of emphasis without intending to deceive. So, I pray for you all the time. That's a hyperbole. It's an exaggeration, but you understand what I'm trying to say. I'm giving the emphasis, but I'm not intending to deceive you at the same time. Or, a million thanks. Those are hyperboles. Another one of these things that is really I've struggled with. We have all this stuff that people don't read anymore. All they do is watch television. Nobody reads Shakespeare anymore. Now wait just a minute. Shakespeare was not given to be read. When Shakespeare was written, it was not for the reading public. It was for the stage. All we've done now is gone back. We've made full circle again. We studied Shakespeare because we couldn't get to the stage. Now, praise God, the stage is right in our living room. Now, whether it's being misused or not, that's not my point of view. The thing is that there are some marvelous things. It's up to the Christian to innovate and to grab hold of these challenges and to do something with them.
Not only that, but Hollywood is, King Henry V, Hamlet.
All that good stuff that's being done. But see, this is a great day for us because people are not thinking that we can help them think in little bits. We just need to learn, and I'm not saying that we adjust down to their level. I'm saying that we take what we have and use it. So I went through this whole thing several years ago as to whether I'm a writer or a communicator. And I determined, no, God does not want me to be a writer. He wants me to be a communicator. Well, if that's the case, then I have to open myself to every form of communication that's available.
This concludes Chapter 4, Write the Way You Talk, by Jamie Buckingham.